Hello and welcome to Inside Education. We're online at insideed.com. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. Coming up on this week's programme.
One of the key things you can do is have early discussions in your courses about it, because a lot of the evidence is that the way students fall into plagiarism is by sloppy note-taking early on that eventually morphs into appropriated text as they iterate towards a final product, and also procrastination feeds into plagiarism.
I'll bring you the second part of my interview on plagiarism. We'll hear what college students and their lecturers can do to reduce the incidence of students passing off other people's ideas as their own. We'll also have a report to mark this week's occurrence of Science Week. But we begin with PISA. Over the last month on the programme, Barry Hennessy has been discussing the PISA test with experts from various countries. In this final instalment of the series, Barry reviews what he has found out about the PISA test.
When Ireland's reading score in PISA 2009 slipped from 9th to 16th out of 34 OECD member states, the alarm bells began to ring at the Department of Education and Skills. Our national score in maths had been showing weakness for some time, but the decline in literacy was seen as the final warning that urgent remedial measures were needed. The response was a national plan for literacy and numeracy launched by Minister Rory Quinn in summer 2011. In this series, we've sought to investigate whether PISA merits the importance that's attached to it, what its shortcomings may be, and how countries can go about improving their national scores. So does PISA matter as much internationally as it appears to in Ireland? Dr. Alberto Rodriguez is an education sector manager for Europe and Central Asia at the World Bank.
We do attach a lot of importance to the ability that these tests have to tell us how education is going in many countries. We also believe that it is very important as countries embark in reforms to be able to put a thermometer of how things are going, of whether students are learning. And this cognitive test actually gives us some answers in that regard.
Emily Richmond is public editor with the National Education Writers Association in Washington, D.C. She recalls the U.S. reaction to the results of PISA 2009.
Last year, when the PISA math scores showed that Shanghai students were the world leaders, President Obama called it a Sputnik moment for the United States. The fact is that U.S. scores on international tests continue to lag behind other industrialized nations, and that is a source of significant political tension here.
Away from the political and media maelstrom, a small but influential group of academics has expressed concern that too much importance is given to one test run by the OECD. Svein Sjoberg is professor of science education at the University of Oslo.
The E in the OECD is not education, it's actually economy. So this is actually an organization which has economic competition and development in a free market economy as a prime target. In fact, that is why we have the OECD. Out of all things that happen in education, they also select their focus according to what is can be defended in sort of economical terms. They are interested, first of all, in basic reading, in basic literacy, which is, reading, being able to understand text. And then it is mathematics, and then it is science. So these three main areas are their concern, which, of course, also is at the neglect of everything else that we find important in school.
Alberto Rodriguez of the World Bank agrees that PISA has its shortcomings.
We do like to think that the skills for the new workforce are not only cognitive skills, but they're also, for example, what's called the non-cognitive soft skills, the ability of people to work in groups, the ability of people to communicate. Now, those particular soft skills or non-cognitive skills are not measured in these tests. They are difficult to measure. There are now some experiences and pilots of measuring some of those. And we are observing those with a lot of attention because we do feel that it will be important, increasingly important, to also venture into identifying when schools are doing well imparting those soft skills and when they're not.
Ireland is not alone in trying to reform its education system in response to poor PISA scores. Emily Richmond in Washington again.
There's a new initiative underway right now. It's known as Race to the Top. And what it's doing is it's encouraging states to more aggressively tackle persistent education problems in exchange for federal funding. This includes revamping teacher licensing policies, turning around lowest performing schools, and encouraging stronger partnerships with community organizations to provide some of those support social services to make up for the deficits that we've talked about that students may be experiencing in their home lives or in their communities. We're also seeing a new emphasis on early childhood education to make sure students are ready to learn when they start school and start off with a strong foundation.
One of the recurring issues in improving PISA scores is the apparently positive role of standardized tests. Hugo Rodriguez is a Canadian journalist who blogs on the site educationreporter.ca.
Alberta and Ontario, British Columbia, use provincially administered standardized testing in math and literacy skills that the students would take two or three times, again, depending on the province, through their primary and secondary educational careers. The idea, though it's not always perceived this way in the media, the idea is that then those results should be guiding instruction so that teachers know where their students' strengths are, where they should be focusing on improving a particular skill set, be it comprehension or the ability to summarize or open response questions or a particular math skill.
Alberto Rodriguez also believes that standardized tests have a key role to play.
If you look at the what's been called in Germany the PISA shock of 2001, when the PISA results came out in 2001, Germany went through a very deep soul-searching because they were simply not doing as well as they thought they were. And in that soul-searching, they actually looked very closely at the results of learning of students between all the subnational levels of government in Germany. And they were stroken by the fact that, indeed, in those regions where there had standardized tests at the end of cycles, those regions were doing better clearly than the regions where they didn't. That is an anecdotal piece of evidence, but there is quite a bit of work out there that indicates that the presence of a standardized test does help teachers and principals focus on learning and measure the areas where learning is happening and those where it isn't.
The next PISA tests in mathematics will be held in 2012. Jude Cosgrove of the Educational Research Centre in Dublin is Ireland's representative on PISA's governing council.
I think the overemphasis on the league tables and the sort of horse race type of approach is very damaging. I think the major area is the issue of capturing trend information. In other words, from cycle to cycle, ascertaining whether achievement within a given country has changed. And I think that is related to the fact that there is a natural tension in PISA between providing an innovative and policy-relevant assessment with keeping it the same to measure change across time.
And that was Jude Cosgrove of the Education Research Centre in Drumcondra closing Barry Hennessy's report for this week, and that concludes Barry's series on the PISA test. I'm now joined in studio by our reporter Sinead Burke. Sinead, what have you been finding out about in the world of education in the last week?
The last 7 days has been Science Week, with many schools involved in activities and events to celebrate the occasion. I wanted to find out more about the importance of science from the perspective of students and teachers, so I met with Dr. Paul Van Kampen of Dublin City University to find out his thoughts on the subject. I started by asking him what primary and post-primary teachers can do to promote and encourage science in their classrooms.
I think, you know, there is clearly a lot wrong with the system, and so changing just one or two aspects is not really going to help all that much, probably. Things really need to change at all levels. But let me make clear very much that it's not the people that I have an issue with. I know many wonderful people who do fantastic work in the classroom, and they develop educational resources and syllabuses, and they improve professional development. So first, well, at each level you ask. So first of all, I'm not really an expert at what goes on at primary level. And I would certainly not want to pretend that everything is fine and rosy in the garden there. But certainly when I see the range of activities that my own 9-year-old engages in, It's not just learning facts or procedures, but, you know, there is an element of playfulness and creativity and group work and all of those things there. And I think that seems to be the norm, whereas at second level, I think it's more the exceptional teacher who finds a way to allow for creativity in the classroom. So again, that's probably not specific to science, but as it applies to science, I think what we do need to do is we need to address the balance that, science is both a body of knowledge and it is about processes of science. And I think at the moment there is such a strong emphasis on the knowledge. I think if we can find more and more ways to engage the students' brains in the classroom, I think a lot would be gained there. But again, it can't be only in science. It needs to be across the board at all levels, at all subjects.
And what advice would you give to teachers and parents who are trying to instill a love of learning for science in their students and children?
Well, I think, first of all, outside the classroom, it would, of course, be a good start if any interest that students have or children have would be encouraged or at least not discouraged. But certainly, you know, within the island of there are wonderful opportunities to bring your children to W5 in Belfast or Black Rock Observatory in Cork. They're two great venues for doing informal science, and, you know, there's a lot to be learned there. And I guess when there are holidays abroad and your child is interested in science, there are so many wonderful science museums around the world. Definitely, you know, there's a lot to be done there. And within the classroom, I do think the main thing is to address the balance between facts and processes. But I really don't want people to go totally the other way and focus on processes only. And I know that inquiry has been a buzzword for trying to affect change, but first of all, some of the things that are peddled about as inquiry really are no more inquiry than painting by numbers, and even things that genuinely are inquiry, they are great and they have a place in the classroom, but it's not just that. There has to be a balance, a range of things to do, but certainly addressing that balance a little bit and having it more about students thinking and less about students memorizing, that'd be great.
And could you say a little bit more about the differences you see it between the process and the product in learning science?
Yes, so I think that, okay, of course, you know, we are talking about a broad spectrum and you're asking me really about the extreme. So it is clear that you cannot have a process of science without knowing any of the products, without knowing any of the facts. And likewise, I mean, just having facts and no process is also unworkable. Where I think the key lies is in having these two interact and come together. But I think if you can arrange a class or a lecture or a lab or a tutorial in such a way that you start with a very good specific example that is difficult enough that all the main points that you want to hit are addressed, but not so difficult that you lose everybody. If you can do that, so that, you know, if you can make students work through that and figure that one example out for themselves, then you can go and generalize and come to that abstraction, and then you can do what everybody has always done, and that is use those abstractions and generalizations and practice it and gain more of a deeper understanding in that way.
And to students who have just signed up for the CAO and will soon fill out their course choices, should they be thinking of a career in science and why?
Well, they should certainly consider it, of course. My honest advice is if you have an interest and an ability in science, maths or engineering, go for it. And if you don't, don't. It's really as simple as that. But certainly, please don't go for something else that you think will make you richer or will be easier to do. I mean, 4 years in college is a long time if you're not doing what you want to do. And even in the current economic climate, I don't think that choosing science or maths or engineering is going to make you any less likely to get a job than any other field.
And that was Paul van Kampen from DCU closing Sinead Burke's report for this week. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programmes can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website, which is insideed.com. On last week's programme, I spoke to Professor Thomas S. Dee from the University of Virginia about the problem of plagiarism in third-level institutions. Along with Professor Brian Jacob from the University of Michigan, Professor D has written a paper called Rational Ignorance in Education, a Field Experiment in Student Plagiarism. Last week on the programme, he explained that plagiarism is the appropriation of someone else's text. It seems to be happening more often now because it's easy for students to cut and paste. Although, as Professor D explained, Shakespeare did it and hip-hop artists do it, plagiarism is a problem where it compromises the accumulation of human capital. In the second part of our interview, I asked him what schools can do to address the problem of plagiarism.
One of the things I think schools can do to address this problem is something like the web tutorial we evaluated in our field experimental research. And part of the promise of this is that it's quite simple. It's very affordable to sort of have this sort of online tutorial. And unlike a lot of interventions, instructional interventions, it's really easy to scale up with high fidelity because, you know, the online tutorial is what it is, and you just sort of need to point students to it and compel them to work their way through it. So, you know, I think for really dynamic teachers and educational institutions, there are opportunities like that out there. And it may be of interest to your readers, we've actually, with our published research on plagiarism, we've made the screenshots of the tutorial we used available for free online. And they could just go to my website to find that.
And is the tutorial itself available on your website, Tom, or is it just the screenshots of it?
Well, it's the screenshots because the tutorial was embedded in some proprietary classroom management software. But but the screenshots would allow someone to sort of reverse engineer that pretty easily.
To plagiarize it even?
To plagiarize it. I know. At the beginning of the tutorial, I should mention that we co-opted the material for our tutorial from resources made available by this consortium of Colby, Bates, and Bowdoin colleges. They've got something called a plagiarism resource site on the internet that included a lot of the rich material we essentially lifted for our tutorial. And to avoid any unintended irony, we cited them extensively in our tutorial. So that's something else that might be of interest to your listeners. There really is low-hanging fruit out there in terms of addressing the problem.
And you studied courses across a number of different programs in the college. And did you find that plagiarism was more widespread in some discipline areas than others?
Well, we only had 28 classrooms, and they were classrooms across the humanities and social sciences. I would say it was pretty even across those, but one of the things I would stress is that this was just one institution, and it was a highly selective institution. Now, and one of the things that was really a pattern we found that was really striking in the data is that plagiarism was much more common among students with weaker academic preparation. In fact, we did an out-of-sample prediction that, you know, the plagiarism rate was only 3 or 4% in our data, but for the average student in the United States, our data suggested plagiarism would have a prevalence rate of something like 18%. And I think that sort of dovetails with the notion that it really is about students' training and background, that when students don't have the capacity to write well and to understand what plagiarism is, they're likely to sort of incidentally fall in to committing it. But I think it's kind of an outstanding empirical question. I think it would make sense for institutions and teachers, individual teachers even, who are concerned about this issue, to collect their papers and go to some of these sort of proprietary web services that can really carefully analyze papers for plagiarized content. And I guess what I would encourage, though, is I think it makes sense for teachers, both morally and just as good policy, to not just use it in a law and order kind of mentality, like we're going to detect people and then, you know, hang them high, to use the sort of phrase from the American West, but rather to create, use it all as kind of a teachable moment.
And the software you used to check the plagiarism was Turnitin, is that right?
That's right. We tried a number of packages, and we thought Turnitin seemed to perform particularly well You know, it has a rich set of data, a pretty sophisticated algorithm. And I think, if anything, one needs to be careful about the prevalence of false positives in those types of things. So, for example, if you were to write something about the European Union in a paper, Turnitin would almost certainly match that to some document that exists somewhere, and that would contribute to a high score, when in fact it might just be an incidental text match. So sometimes we found that the accumulation of what were incidental text matches could create the appearance of a high plagiarism score, when on closer inspection it really wasn't plagiarism. So, you know, there's sort of a caveat emptor there, I think, in using that. I think for a first pass, that software is useful. But if you think you found something, you really want to look carefully to see whether it is indeed plagiarism.
You also found that males were more likely to plagiarize than females.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, those sort of gender differences are always provocative, but sort of defy easy explanation as well. I mean, if your next question is why that is so, I would hesitate to offer any sort of conjecture. But there always seems to be gender differences in all kinds of educational interventions that are, you know, both provocative and inexplicable.
And for, you know, you mentioned how students are more likely to have an easy attitude to plagiarism now because of the prevalence of cutting and pasting. But how has technology changed the detection of plagiarism? I mean, is it really the usefulness of software like Turnitin? Is that the big bonus or the big assistance that technology offers?
Well, this is just casual empiricism on my part. I mean, I don't think proprietary services like Turnitin.com are actually used all that often by faculty. And again, partly because faculty do not see detection as their core responsibility. And I should also note that you don't have to talk to very many university faculty to get horror stories about when they may have brought charges against the student, because they immediately get drawn into intensely bureaucratic, legalistic procedures where they often feel as if they're the ones on trial for having committed some infraction. So that's another reason. Faculty just tend to shy away from this, think of it as someone else's problem. Now, to the extent that faculty do police it kind of unilaterally, I think many of them just fire up their Google machine and, will take a paper or a phrase that they come across in a student-submitted work and see if they can track down its original source.
And for students who then are detected at plagiarism, what kind of consequences typically do apply if a lecturer does find some incidents?
Yeah, again, I think this is part of the problem. Again, at least anecdotally, at institutions in the U.S. where the probability of detection is low, the probability of punishment conditional on detection is thought to be quite low, and then the nature of the punishment is often quite low as well. So there's this perception, at least among faculty, I think hard data are lacking, but the perception is that when students are punished, it's often a kind of slap on the wrist, such as accepting a zero for an assignment. And again, all of that feeds into this environment where no one's minding the store. You know, no one's really educating students about how they can avoid this problem in the first place.
So maybe then it sounds like an issue that's more relevant at postgraduate level, and that it's more likely to be actively pursued at postgraduate level rather than for undergraduates. Would that be right?
Well, postgraduate, if you mean professionals out in the field.
I actually mean people who are maybe doing master's programs or doing doctoral programs.
Well, I'm not sure there's much detection there either. I mean, I think that would, no one has really studied that very carefully. I think the people who tend to be caught are the people who are high profile and have sort of large targets on them. I'm thinking of the prominent historians, for example, in the U.S. who have been caught out in plagiarism. It's because they're worth catching in some sense, and their work is widely read, that they're eventually found out. I don't think there's much detection going on at postgraduate, undergraduate or the secondary level. But again, I would caution people to not get caught up in the idea simply that we need more of a law and order mentality around this. I think we need to have an education mentality around it. And there are simple things available like this, cheap online tutorial that we developed that I think can provide effective remediation.
And in addition to doing that tutorial, would you offer any other advice to students who want to get off to a solid start in their academic career and really would want to avoid plagiarizing?
Well, I think, I think one of the key things you can do is have early discussions in your courses about it, because a lot of the evidence is that the way students fall into plagiarism is by sloppy note-taking early on that eventually morphs into appropriated text as they iterate towards the final product. And also procrastination feeds into plagiarism. When someone lets an assignment sit until the 11th hour and then they have to pull something together, and I think many of us, I include myself in this, sort of all too frequently work that way, that creates a high-risk environment where the things you're reading and that are informing your own work product can end up being appropriated inappropriately. So I think having that discussion and joining students to kind of understand what plagiarism is and work early on to develop good practices to avoid it can be extremely effective. Now, I think really careful teachers, the other thing they will do is have a draft process that might give students feedback as they move towards their final product about whether there are problems in the text they're citing and in their practices.
Okay, and that's very practical advice. Supposing you learn off material from a text in preparing for an exam, and then you go into the exam and you don't have the text with you, but you reproduce verbatim in the exam what was in the text, is that plagiarism, even though you've learned it off by heart yourself?
Well, I suppose technically it would be, but I think it would be rather a strict-minded teacher who would sort of pursue that in a punitive way, because I think the assessment as it's designed in some sense encouraged that. If it created an environment where someone was essentially going to be rewarded for reconstituting the core material, I would view that as legitimate. And if anything, I would suggest to the teacher that maybe the way they design the test questions wasn't appropriate, because maybe they would want to frame a question in such a way that it encouraged students to have some sort of creative analytical synthesis rather than simply reward them for regurgitating material.
And that was Professor Thomas S.D. from the University of Virginia, and we'll put a link to his tutorial for avoiding plagiarism on the programme's website. That's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com or on iTunes. You can email us at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to my guest, Professor Thomas S.D., and to my colleagues Barry Hennessy and Sinead Burke. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.